Hey, hey, this is Teresa Matsura, and you're listening to the 100th episode of Uncanny Japan. 100. It took a while to get here, but we're here. And it wouldn't have happened if not for all of you. So I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for tuning in, reaching out, supporting, leaving a review, and spreading the word about the show to friends and family. Thank you all. I started the podcast in October of 2016, and I'm not sure exactly what I expected to happen, but I can tell you one thing that totally surprised me, and that is how incredibly smart, kind, and awesome you are. No, I don't talk to all of you, but the listeners and supporters of the show that I've had the joy of interacting with are just incredible. Another thing I've learned along the way is you have stories too. So for the 100th episode, I kind of threw out the idea, how about you tell me any weird or ghostly experiences that you've had while visiting or living in Japan? I was nervous about whether or not I'd get enough replies to even do an entire show. But I was delighted that not only did I get enough creepy and freaky real-life experiences for the 100th episode, I have enough for 3 shows. The submissions also group into nice categories. So there's going to be 3 themes. Today is haunted or ghostly houses. I'm actually going to read one strange experience that really resonated with me for reasons I'll share later. The next episode is going to be something like When the Ghostie Gets You. I'll read a couple great stories that came in from listeners and again share one of my own experiences. This one's really messed up and I don't usually like talking about it. But it really fits the theme, so I think I'll share. I'll end that episode with a couple sweeter experiences that were sent in. Then the 3rd episode in the series will be The Strange and Unsettling Outdoors. Again, I'll read several pieces that were sent in about the topic and talk about them too. So this 100th episode is going to be 3 shows. A little different, a little scary, but a lot of fun. Oh, and do you like the new background music? Julian made that for us, and I think it fits perfectly. Would you like to explore the stranger, more obscure corners of Japanese culture? Dig a little deeper into superstitions, curious customs, and all those mysterious creatures that inhabit the land? If so, then this is the podcast for you. Uncanny Japan is where I, author Teresa Matsura, share all the fascinating tidbits I unearth while doing research for my writing. From the bizarre to the ghastly, and everything in between. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome back to our 100th episode. Now get ready for some curious and spooky tales. Today's experience was sent in from Kate. Kate reached out to me a while back, and she's one of those people who you meet and you have the peculiar, overwhelming combination of emotions, partly, where have you been all my life? Partly, wait, have we known each other forever? And partly, you kind of wonder if you had chosen a couple different paths back down the line, would you be living a similar existence? And a little bit you wish you had. She's lived in Japan, had incredible experiences, became a Buddhist priest, and has more incredible experiences. I'm waiting for her to write her memoir. But here, let me read you her story. I lived in a haunted house in Yamanashi Prefecture. It wasn't an old, musty cottage filled with soot sprites. No. It was a brand new house that my husband and I had built on a mountainside overlooking peach orchards and grapevines. It had a view across the Kōshū Valley to the majestic snow-capped Akaishi Mountains, the Southern Alps. The house was on the outskirts of a small village, next door to an ancient temple that was once a major center of esoteric Buddhism and a central training place for Shugendo ascetic mountain monks. The old temple was now quite run down, and the many sub-temples now gone, with just an old cemetery up behind the temple. The first inkling that the house was haunted was when my 3-year-old daughter came into my bedroom and woke me in the middle of the night, wanting to get into bed with me. "Why, what's wrong, sweetie? Did you have a bad dream?" "No," she said, "but there's a girl in my room and I don't like her. She's a white shadow." "Okay, sweetie," I said sleepily and making way for her in the bed. It wasn't until the next day that I pondered what she'd said. A little girl who was a white shadow? Isn't that just the way a small child with no knowledge of the word ghost might describe one? I questioned her more about it, and she described how the little girl had come out of the floor and stood by her bed, but didn't say anything. That was the start of a number of sightings of the little girl by different people who stayed with us over the following year or so. We had many friends from overseas who came to visit, and not knowing that anyone else had made any such report, because we certainly didn't advertise it, they started reporting various phenomena. Was there a matsuri in the middle of the night? I heard people singing. What was that sound like marching I heard during the night? Was someone crying last night? My sister, a really straight, no-nonsense kind of woman, who looked after my daughter in the house one time when I needed some medical care on my return, said to me, "Well, I don't believe in ghosts, but your house is haunted." One night, she had seen a little girl walk past her door, and believing it was my daughter out of her bed for some reason, followed her, only to see her disappear out through the wall and find my daughter sound asleep in bed. There was never any sense of malevolence, and curiously, no one seemed particularly frightened. But the strange sounds and music and singing and marching and ghostly appearances continued. So I decided to investigate the history of the place in depth to see if I could find any reasons why this was happening. I was very matter-of-fact about it all and set out like a detective. I asked the old people in the village about the land that we had bought to build our house, which had been sold to us by the temple. I learned that the field at the base of the slope below our house, where a new baseball field was built, was called Hanatori, the kanji of which read flower bird. However, I was told that the kanji for this name had actually been changed in the last century and was previously the same sounding words for cut-off noses. It was the location of a fierce and bloody battle during the 1600s, and the victors had sliced off the noses of the defeated and piled them up there as a humiliating sign of defeat. I learned that there had been a warning beacon and a fort right up behind our house on the mountains, where the troops gathered and watched the movement of the enemies below on the plain. I also learned that the cemetery behind the temple was quite new. Between our house and the temple was a vacant block of land, then a stream, then the temple. Apparently, the stream kept flooding the old cemetery, which had been on the vacant block between us and the temple. The old gravestones were moved up to the new cemetery. But there were many old graves that were unmarked, and the villagers no longer knew who was buried there from centuries before. It occurred to us that all the sounds and apparitions had appeared on the side of the house facing that block of land. One old man remembered playing among the abandoned graves when he was a little boy. He recommended that we contact the local shrine and have the shrine priest conduct an exorcism. We consulted the shrine priest, and he readily agreed to conduct the exorcism and gave me a list of things that I needed to buy as offerings to the spirits to be placed on an altar in the house. The list included fish from the sea and fruit and vegetables and herbs from the mountains. I went to the supermarket in the nearby city to find the right kind of fish. I was looking through the fish for sale when the person in charge of the fish section came up and said, "Oh yes, good choice. You're in luck today. Those fish are on special, really tasty. How are you going to cook it?" So I told him straight out, "This is for an exorcism." He looked startled. But it wasn't because I said it was for an exorcism. It was because the supermarket fish weren't good enough for that ritual. "Oh no," he said. "You must go directly to the fish market in the city wholesale market. Here's the name of a fellow you need to see." Upon which he wrote down the name of the fish guy who'd be able to give me the good fish. I went into the main wholesale city market, into the fish section, and asked around for the fish seller that I'd been recommended, and was pointed to a large, rather fearsome-looking fellow who seemed decidedly put out that there was a gaijin in his fish market. I explained that I'd been recommended by the fish guy in the supermarket and told him I needed a fish for an exorcism. His whole demeanor changed as he plunged his hands into the buckets of ice and pulled out one fish after another, muttering, "No, this one hasn't got clear enough eyes. No, this one's mouth is open." Until he was satisfied he'd found just the right one. He handed me the fish, but refused to take any money for it. Next, I collected the necessary fruits and vegetables, being careful now to pick only the unblemished and perfect ones. I then went to the stationery store to get the envelopes to put the cash donation for the shrine priest. The storekeeper, an old Oba-chan, asked me if she could help, and when I told her it was for an exorcism, she didn't bat an eye, but disappeared out back, returning with a very austere money envelope in black and white and gold, on which she wrote some kanji I couldn't read. And when I went to pay for it, she refused payment and instead wished me good luck. The priest arrived for the exorcism and carefully checked over the altar we had prepared and was satisfied with everything. He chanted the ritual with much dramatic flair and then proceeded to walk through the house going into every room, even the toilets, continuously chanting. And even though we said nothing to him about it, when he came to any room in which there had been an apparition or strange sounds, he stopped and said, "Here," and chanted more loudly and told us to place salt in the corners of those rooms. And he was right every time. Well, that is how it happened. And did the exorcism work? No, unfortunately, it did not. After several months of quiet, the sounds and apparitions returned. So instead, I just set up an altar and lit incense and placed flowers and chanted the Heart Sutra every day, in the hope that the restless spirits would be calmed by my efforts. The end. I can so relate to Kate's story. Something a little bit along the same vein happened to me and my family. But first, getting that special altar ready. I remember when my mother-in-law insisted an oharai be done to me. An oharai is a Shinto cleansing or purification ritual. Also sort of a low-key exorcism. There were certain things that I needed to get ready as well. My job wasn't half as difficult as Kate's, though. My mother-in-law took care of most of it, you know, to get it right. But I was in charge of buying these little ceramic saucers for salt. Not just any salt, mind you, but a special salt that comes from Suruga Bay. And it's been prepared with lots of sunshine and wind. Anyway, about the saucers, I was told specifically that they can't sit flat on the floor, that they had to have these little bumps on the bottom, or feet, to raise them up. I found some. They were expensive, but I still use them today for serving very, very small foods, or soy sauce for sushi, 20 years later, so they've paid for themselves. Another thing I really like about Kate's experience is the fact that other people, not just the Shinto priest, felt, saw, and heard the presences. When you get unbelieving people saying, "Okay, that just happened," well, it feels good to be believed. Speaking of being believed, here's a little story. Before my Oharai ceremony, because my mother-in-law insisted I had some spirit following me around, we visited a woman who was known to be quite powerful in getting rid of such things. She was also blind. I was a little skeptical, not of her at all, but my mother-in-law accusing me of carrying around a ghost. I felt perfectly fine. I remember going to the woman's place at night for a meeting, a kind of pre-exorcism, if you will. It was me, my husband, my in-laws, and Julian, 5 of us. We took off our shoes, and she called us into the altar room in the back, where we kneeled Seiza style in front of her. We were there to discuss the details of the ceremony. The first thing the woman said was, "Oh, there are 6 of you here tonight." "No, there's only 5. She pulls back a little. "That's strange. I distinctly feel 6 people in the room." My mother-in-law gave me the biggest "I told you so" face. I'm sure she was a little happy that I believed her now. It was creepy. Another thing I like about Kate's story is her sleuthing. I love that there was a history to the land that no one really talked about, and that the kanji for Hanatori had been changed to make it less gruesome. Now let me tell you about what happened to Julie and me after we moved into our new house when he was in kindergarten. It's got some similar points. First, keep in mind my husband at the time was mostly absent, doing something called Tanshin Funin. It's not an uncommon practice where the company sends the husband to work in another prefecture, away from the home. Evidently, it's cheaper than moving the whole family. And people also don't want to disturb their children's education. But basically, it means families only get to see their husband or daddy once or twice a month, depending on where he's working. Sometimes less than that. So for years, it was mostly just Julian and me. The land we bought to build the new house on was previously a vegetable garden. But nearby, there was a very windy road with lots of old homes on it. This tells you that it's been there for a long time because it was once a footpath. On that road, not far from our house, was a small unmanned shrine called Dobara Inari Shrine. No big deal, really, because there are little shrines and statues everywhere in Japan. But after we moved into the house, quite a few strange things started happening. The biggest and the most shocking fits more into the next episode of the show. But this story kind of started it all, and it happened in Julian's room. I didn't even consider this until I read Kate's story, but Julian's room was in the recommended by both the realtor and a Shinto priest, lucky southeast direction. It just occurred to me, though, that that was also the closest room in the house to that windy road and that little shrine. Anyway, Julian began having bad dreams. And a lot of kanashibari, sleep paralysis. And then some other weird things began happening. Not all the time, but occasionally. The most concerning, I guess, was the period when he would wake up in the middle of the night with a feeling that someone was in the room. We'd already set up a nightlight to be kept on, so he said when he opened his eyes and looked over at the desk, there was a head sitting there, staring at him. He'd close his eyes again, convince himself that it was just his imagination, open them again, and there it was, still staring at him. Then he'd bury himself in his blankets and tell me about it the next day. When it got real bad, we'd do a purification thing with incense and salts and tell the head to stay away, and it would for a while, but then it would return. So this went on for a couple years. There would be periods of relative calm. Then he'd start talking about the head being back or waking to find the closet door open. He really didn't like the closet. I called him the other day to compare what he remembered and what I remembered. And he said that the only thing that really helped and made it all stop was having our beagle, Chacha Madu, sleep with him up there. I didn't do what Kate did and ask around, though, although I should have. Then I would have asked for a proper oharai. Instead, most of the neighbors nearby were new, and the land felt new, except for that one windy road. So I guess I didn't even think about it. But one day, while I was talking to one of the older folk who lived next to the shrine, he called it Kubizuka Jinja. I understood what he meant, and I asked to hear more. Remember Nekozuka and Nezumizuka from the last episode? Cat grave and rat grave? Yeah, well, Kubi means neck or head. The head grave shrine. The story I was told was that in the year 1570, on February 8th, the Sengoku daimyo Takeda Shingen of what is now Yamanashi Prefecture was attacking the nearby Hanazawa Castle. The lord of the castle, Ohara, and his men fought a strong fight, but they were defeated on March 3rd of that year. Some of Ohara's men became vassals to Takeda Shingen, while Ohara and a good many of his followers moved on toward western Shizuoka. Only they didn't make it very far, because Takeda Shingen's men were pursuing them. There was another battle in exactly the area where we built our house, and many soldiers died. The tale went that their heads were lopped off and they were lined up along the road. But the story I found online said that there were just bodies everywhere. After that, everyone in the area started having bad luck, seeing ghost fires and other weird things happening. So much so that as soon as it started to get dark, they'd close their rain shutters and stay inside. Finally, someone said hiding all the time wasn't going to get the rice planted or harvested. So they suggested that they build a shrine to honor and lay to rest the spirits of those who had been decapitated and killed. Kubizuka Jinja. It was built, offerings were made, and the ghosties calmed down. For the most part, I guess. My story for next episode is a doozy. But aside from that one, I do have a little experience in Julian's room. There were a couple months long after he'd gone away to college when I was sleeping there. It was the only bed in the house and I was tired of sleeping on the futon. At first, everything was fine, but it got to the point where sometimes it felt like I wasn't alone. There was that buzz that happens when someone's nearby. You turn around quickly, but there's no one there. I never saw a head, but I remember I always kept my back pushed up against the wall, and I always made sure the closet door was closed. I don't even know why. But even now, if I walk into a room and the closet is open, I freak out a little. If you happen to be nearby, prepare for my lecture about how we don't let scary things out of the closet, do we now? As I shut the door again. There was one tiny odd thing that happened there before I stopped sleeping in the room altogether. It was late at night and I was lying in bed talking to a friend on the phone. The house was quiet and there was a pause in our conversation when something brought my attention to one of Julian's posters on the wall above me. I looked up and just then a pin popped out, audibly. And it didn't just fall, but it flew, landing in the middle of the room. Even my friend on the phone asked, what was that? Chacha had passed away already, and I wasn't sticking around to find out why I was so squicked out about that closet. When I mentioned this to Julian right after it happened, he just laughed and said, oh, that isn't the half of it. So I'm going to wrap up today's show here. Thank you all again. We made it to 100 episodes. You're all the best. There's still a bunch more ghostly, creepy, and even a couple heartwarming listener stories coming up. The next episode is going to be very dark and unnerving, with a little sweetness at the end to lighten things up. Thank you for listening. Thank everyone for sharing your experiences, and I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye. You've reached the end of the show, and I just want you to know how much we appreciate you listening and supporting us. Any subscribing, reviewing, and gushing to your friends, family, even random strangers really does help keep us going. If you have the means and you want to help a little more and get a little more, we are making extra content over on Patreon, all for only $5 a month. Or, if you like to read horror, you might be interested in my Bram Stoker-nominated short story collection, The Carp-Faced Boy and Other Tales. 本当にありがとうございます。Thank you again, and I'll talk to you real soon.